This is The Beat, a podcast series that keeps you in the know about the latest community policing topics facing our nation.
So hello and welcome. My name is Nizmia Comrie, and on behalf of the COPS office, I would like to continue the discussion with Acting Director of National Drug Control Policy, Michael Botticelli, and Vermont State Police Colonel Tom L'Esperance on public health, public safety collaborations, and law enforcement use of naloxone in part two of this podcast series. Acting Director Botticelli, in many instances nationwide, we have heard that implementing a naloxone program into law enforcement agencies has enhanced collaborative partnerships between public safety, community organizations, and residents to enhance solutions to the problems and increase trust. Is that the norm? In addition, Colonel L'Esperance, what impact has your naloxone program had in this regard?
I think fortunately this concept of inclusiveness at the community level and collaboration among a wide number of stakeholders, so local law enforcement, youth serving agencies, residents and families who are impacted, health and human service agencies, I think people have understood that this is where the solutions are, that each of the community stakeholders has a role to play in dealing with this epidemic that we have here. And again, I think while people have come together over looking at overdose prevention and naloxone distribution, I think the kind of fortunate consequence and fortunate byproduct of that is that it really has fostered better and enhanced communication, really looking at a holistic and comprehensive response to this issue.
You know, I'd follow up that my goal is to have people call 911, and I don't want people, individuals, or groups to be afraid to call 911. Anticipating that they may get arrested for something that involves an overdose or potential overdose. So by having troopers carry naloxone, if that's what it takes for someone to pick up the phone and make that call immediately, because time is of the essence, to get that trooper there and to have them respond and potentially take someone out from the grips of death, that's going to, in and of itself, bolster relationship in communities that we don't necessarily have a partnership with. So already we've seen some changes where now we're on a first-name basis with treatment folks. I'm a true believer that law enforcement is the number one ticket to drug rehab. An arrest sometimes has to be made to get someone in there. And I think if you speak to people that have been in the program before, a lot of times that's what it takes to hit rock bottom. So if we're there, we're trusted, we can get there and help at that level, that then this program will be successful.
I think Colonel L'Esperance just perfectly articulated kind of what's happening across this country, and that law enforcement is seen as part of the solution to the problem. You know, I have my own history with substance use issues, and law enforcement, it took me a long time not to be afraid of the police. And I think now what we're seeing and what he just articulated was how law enforcement is part of the problem, and communities are seeing law enforcement as really the ticket to treatment, and quite honestly, the ticket to saving their lives.
Thank you. Colonel L'Esperance, some agencies may be concerned about what barriers they may face in implementing a naloxone program. Did you experience any resistance from officers, executive staff, community, or policymakers? Any legal barriers? And how did you respond? In addition, Acting Director Botticelli, what have you seen on the national level?
Well, the training that we received initially was brought on from the Albany Medical Center and a particular doctor here in Northern Vermont, Dr. Roberts. And I made it a point that I attend this training with a number of other troopers. I needed them to see and understand that this was coming from the top and that I was passionate about this. And not only were we just looking into it, but it was going to take place. It was just a matter of how and when. But as I watched this training unfold, as I was watching the instructors, I was also watching the reaction of the troopers to kind of gauge what their thought process may be. Again, I've been in the state, on the state police for 28 years, and there were troopers in the room with 5 and 10 years. And we have in law enforcement, you can become cynical relatively quickly. And I just wanted to see the reaction of the troopers and how this program could roll out or how would it roll out. And some of the materials that were used, I keyed right in on. They had a couple of addicts from Maine that were on a video discussing how they were brought out of an overdose state 3 and 4 and 5 times and kind of laughing amongst themselves about how insignificant it was. Maybe it was significant at the time, but look, we made it. And that's not the message that I really wanted going out to the troopers, because immediately it puts them on the defensive as they don't even care about their own lives. Why should we care? So I started to formulate some thoughts during the training to see if I could counter that a bit, and then I opened it right up to, you could be a first responder where you arrive at a child's house with a 3-year-old that got into a grandparent's medicine cabinet. Would you not want to have this at your fingertips to save that child? Or if there was a homeless person, for instance, that you came upon, and you're looking at this person, you're thinking, you know, looks homeless, doesn't care about their own life. However, they just got back from Afghanistan for the second or third tour, developed a habit, and now they're in an overdose state. We would be jumping over each other's shoulders to save that person. And then there's everybody in between. Everybody's got a mother, a brother, a father, a cousin that loves them. Our job as first responders is first and foremost to save someone's life. I don't care if they're in a burning car after stealing or robbing a bank, or if they, in fact, are in an overdose state from shooting, injecting heroin into their arms. Anybody that comes on the state police, or any police officer in their right mind, wants to save someone's life. So I did everything I could to kind of change the conversation to the point where this is much bigger than just, you know, the everyday addict that you encounter. I don't care if it takes 3 or 4 or 5 times to get this person into treatment, but if we're there, we administer the naloxone, EMS then takes them to the hospital. That may be their first introduction to public health care. Otherwise, they may never get there. So there were some barriers. I worked with the union president very quickly. I had a conversation with Mike O'Neill, our union president, and in about 20 seconds, we both agreed this is not only the right thing to do, it has to be done. So across the conversations that I've had since then, these same questions come up. As most recently as Sunday afternoon, there were some chiefs and colonels that had the same questions. And I think after we opened the discussion up to not just the addicts, but there's other potential officer safety issues related to fentanyl. If an officer roadside is searching a vehicle and opens up a package that contains fentanyl and gets exposed to it, the officer could or would go immediately into an overdose state. Another reason to carry this, but I don't want to lose sight of the reason we carry it is because there is an opiate problem here in our state, and we are first responders. We have an obligation to respond, be equipped, and save that person's life.
I think what the colonel just articulated, we hear nationally that sometimes law enforcement agencies have some, and it's usually pretty minor issues with it, that having this direct law enforcement to law enforcement conversation, I think, really, really helps. I actually just attended a training in New York City for New York City police officers, where they had videos of officer testimonials who had administered naloxone, and you could see the reaction in the people who were being trained, and you could see actually the emotion in the officers who had reversed someone and what it meant to them about saving someone's life. Lieutenant Glynn in Quincy tells the story now that a badge of honor for Quincy officers is now to talk about how many lives that they've been able to save. And, you know, the colonel, I think, raised an interesting issue that merits some discussion, is that, you know, one of the hallmarks of some people with addiction is that they relapse. And sometimes we do have to reverse people. And I don't want officers to see that as a sign that we're just perpetuating substance use by saving someone's life. And, you know, as he articulated, this is someone's son, this is someone's daughter, someone's brother, someone, and every life is worth saving. Our ultimate goal is to get people into treatment and recovery, but we have to keep them alive to do it.
Thank you. For law enforcement agencies interested in implementing a naloxone program, what steps did you take to implement your program, and what should they know before starting the process?
Well, I would recommend they go to the toolkit right away, because I think looking that over, all of the questions that were asked and raised and most of the discussions that I've had are in fact articulated in the toolkit. So take a look at that, and that will help you pave the way. For those states that have strong union representation, I would suggest you bring union representatives right into the conversation at the outset. Partner with your Department of Health to see what role they can play, because they are probably the most important partner to us right now. They provided the funding, the training, did some training with us where we trained the trainer, where we have troopers in each barracks that can then do the practical piece of the training. And again, you know, I can't emphasize it enough. It has to be emphasized from the top down. I think if you're a chief or sheriff or a colonel, you need to not sell the program, because I don't think that does it justice. You have to push this program out with conviction. And as the acting director mentioned again, everybody's family. There are families in law enforcement. I asked recently, I didn't need anyone to raise their hands, but if anybody in this room, and there were people from all over the country, do you have someone in your family that has an addiction problem? And I didn't need anybody to raise their hands, but I would suggest that 90% of the people in that room did, or they don't know that they do, but they will find out soon enough. So this affects all walks of life. So that message from the top down and having those conversations with our partner law enforcement agencies helped me anyhow to develop the program and implement that program.
And what type of training do you provide your officers? How often and how are you funding the training and the naloxone purchases?
Yeah, we have an e-learning program that the troopers go online so they don't have to go to a central location to get the initial training, which just kind of spells out what naloxone is, that the upside of naloxone, how it can be administered. And it takes about 30 to 45 minutes to go through that training. There's then a practical that we had, as I mentioned earlier, the train-the-trainer program. We have a trooper in each barracks that's been trained by our Department of Health to put this on, and that's about a 30-minute training. And each barracks and every trooper in the state has had that training. I think the way we're going to continue to roll out the program is to implement this program with our CPR and first aid training. Honestly, I think that we could back it up with numbers if I had done the research, that more often than not, officers across the country will save a life using naloxone as opposed to CPR. I think more likely to come upon someone in an overdose state than in cardiac arrest. I think that answers that.
Acting Director Botticelli and Colonel Esperance, with overdose being a public health concern, what would be your recommendations to other agencies on public health collaboration?
You know, first and foremost, I think what has really been underscored by this conversation is two things. One, leadership, of finding leaders both within your public health agencies and in your public safety agencies. Get to know one another. Really focus on how do we get to know each other's issues and responsibilities, and how can we present a united front here? I think that's where we've seen, and I think you heard the Colonel talk about, you know, just how impactful one dedicated leadership can be, but also the integral role that public safety in partnership with public health really can play a strong role here. I think that these are examples of how we can make sure that we have good leadership both at the federal level but also at the state and local level, and really kind of what we can do and put forward with these kinds of collaborations.
And I agree, Director. I think some of the relationships that were developed as a result of the heroin epidemic and the naloxone program have helped us in our conversations related to Ebola. The people that we're working with are the same individuals, the same groups that we worked with for the heroin and opiate problem. So those relationships started then, they continue now, and will only continue to grow. And anytime we're public health bisect with public safety, we have a core group of leadership that will be able to address any problem, any issue that they're confronted with as a result of this program and as a result of the relationship that we've got it.
Colonel Esperance, how do you all work with your treatment providers?
In a lot of respects, we're on a first-name basis now, and we've brought their program to the streets, if you will. In some of our largest sweeps, our arrest sweeps, we now look at those individuals that are more likely selling to provide their own habit or to work with their own addiction. Those individuals that are arrested, the last person they should see at a state police barracks would be someone from the treatment side of the house that can at least have a quick conversation with them, maybe provide them with some literature, that type of thing, before they go off to see a judge and or go to jail. However, I can't lose sight of those individuals, those mid-level dealers, those higher-level dealers that are either bringing heroin and other drugs into our state or are already here up and running. Those individuals are, in fact, going to jail. And we've been able to take a look through a different lens of those that are just supporting their own habits and those that are committing felonies beyond just the distribution, but of robbing stores and banks and things like that. That there's a different approach to those individuals, which is, I think, is very healthy when we look at the approach to this problem as a whole. So those relationships have helped us, and I hope that they will continue to grow.
the colonel just articulated what our national drug control policy looks like as it relates to dealing with the intersection of public health and public safety. You know, we want to make sure that we're diverting people who come into contact with the criminal justice system largely as a function of their own addiction away. And I think we've all learned together that kind of arrest and incarcerating those folks are not only expensive but really ineffective. But what we do know is that some people, particularly traffickers, dealers, violent offenders, do need to be in jail. And so we really want to make sure that we are preserving our law enforcement resources, both at the federal and state level and the local level, for those folks that do need to be incarcerated, and making sure that we're giving other people good care and good treatment.
Thank you. So finally, Acting Director Botticelli and Colonel L'Esperance, what other ways can agencies engage in public health and public safety collaborations?
You know, I go back to kind of what the Colonel just talked about, and I think the overdose prevention and the naloxone distribution programs have spurred broader conversation about diverting people away from the criminal justice system. And, you know, we all have finite resources on the public health side and the public safety side. And so we want to make sure that we're using those resources for those folks who need it, and really looking at things like diversionary opportunities to make sure that we are not just saving someone's life again, but how are we making sure that we're getting them good care and good treatment? You know, interaction with law enforcement can be a really powerful motivator for someone to seek care. And so, you know, they, again, play a really critical role in the community and in someone's life in terms of strongly suggesting that someone get care and treatment. And so I think that the overdose prevention has spurred ongoing collaboration between a continued response to the not only the opioid epidemic, but substance use in general, by making sure that we are each using our limited resources to the best and most effective way possible.
And I would follow up with the director by saying one of the greatest advancements in law enforcement since 9/11 was the building of our fusion centers. Our fusion centers, each state has a fusion center, and some have more, of gathering information and intelligence and sharing that with other law enforcement agencies. Well, the New Jersey State Police has developed a program called the Drug Monitoring Initiative. And within that program, they're bringing together many partners from outside law enforcement to share information, not necessarily about individuals, but about the overdose deaths, tracking overdose deaths, tracking the heroin that's traveling up and down the East Coast and as fusion centers from across the country. I know DEA is involved now. Sharing that type of information across the country and trying to get our arms around, if someone overdoses in a more urban area, yet they're from a rural section of a state, it may indicate that if we have a few overdose deaths, individuals from rural sections of that state, that area of the state may need to change their prevention techniques or their treatment programs and things like that. By having all these partners enter into agreements and share information that they can bring to the table, it doesn't violate any HIPAA rules or anything like that. I think collectively this partnership that's developed at this level with leadership in each of those entities, prevention, treatment, and law enforcement, will be able to share information and hopefully get a better grasp on how we can approach this issue.
Thank you, Acting Director Botticelli and Colonel L'Esperance, for providing us with your expertise and time today.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
The Beat was brought to you by the United States Department of Justice COPS Office. The COPS Office helps to keep our nation's communities safe by giving grants to law enforcement agencies, developing community policing publications, developing partnerships, and solving problems.
The opinions contained herein are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice. References to specific agencies, companies, products, or services should not be considered an endorsement by the authors or the U.S. Department of Justice. Rather, the references are illustrations to supplement discussion of the issues.